Okay, so picture this. You're trying to copyright like a series of movements, but the goal of those movements is literally to make you healthier.
Sounds a little out there, right?
All right, like how do you even begin to wrap your head around that? But it actually happened. That's the core of this whole Bikram's yoga, call it V-Evelation yoga case. And honestly, it kind of throws a wrench in how we normally think about intellectual property, especially when you start mixing it with these practical functional systems.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's so interesting about this case, and I mean, it's a big deal for anyone studying law, is that it really makes you confront this really basic question. Why did the court decide that Bikram Chaudhary, I mean, he developed this whole 26-pose yoga sequence. Why couldn't that be protected by copyright?
It's a huge question.
It is, because this isn't just like a weird footnote in IP law, right?
Right.
It gets at the very heart of what copyright is even supposed to do.
100%. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about just some random routine he threw together, right? Mm-hmm. Bikram Chaudhary put serious time and effort into developing this specific sequence. And it's not just the poses themselves. It's 26 of them, plus two breathing exercises, all done in a super specific order, and often in a heated room, which adds a whole other layer. Way back in 1979, he copyrighted a book that explained the whole thing in detail. Then, get this, in 2002, he went on a separate copyright registration, specifically for this compilation of exercises. So you got to wonder, with all that, how did it not end up being protected?
That is like the million-dollar question right there. It's like you hit the nail on the head. He copyrighted the book.
Yeah.
So that's what's interesting. That's what sparks this whole need for further legal action regarding just this sequence of poses. You know, what couldn't that initial copyright on the book cover?
Yeah. Exactly. What was missing there? So, okay, let's fast forward a bit. Some of his former teachers, Mark Drost and Zofia Samson, they decide to, you know, go out on their own, start their own yoga studios called it Evelation Yoga. They started offering these hot yoga classes that were very, very similar to Bikram's.
Mm-hmm.
And boom, that's where the legal fireworks went off. Bikram, he hits them with a lawsuit in 2011 saying they're infringing on his copyright by teaching and using his sequence without his permission.
Yeah. And if you zoom out for a second and look at like the big picture, you can see where things could have gotten really messy if Bikram had actually won this case. Imagine the implications for all sorts of stuff, anything that involves steps done in order to get a specific result. Exercise programs would be affected, maybe even stuff like cooking, the culinary arts. It's kind of a lot to think about.
It's huge. It's like, where do you even draw the line?
Yeah.
And that's exactly the kind of territory the courts had to figure out. So in this deep dive, that's what we're going to do. We're going to break down the legal logic behind why the Ninth Circuit ultimately ruled against Bikram. We're going to get into the core principles that are at play here and see how they affect all sorts of things, not just the yoga world. Okay, so clearly, Bikram was convinced this sequence was his baby, his creation, something he should have complete control over.
Oh, for sure. He don't just like stumble on these poses randomly. I mean, he put them together, refined the order, like his whole teaching method revolved around this system.
Yeah.
And I think that timeline you laid out is really important. The first copyright, the one on the book, that was back in 79. That protected his specific expression of the sequence, right? The words he used, the pictures, his whole way of describing it. But what really stands out to you about this whole two-step thing? First the book, then trying to protect the compilation of exercises. Do you think maybe he didn't fully understand what copyright actually covered?
It almost seems like he was going for like the ultimate safety net, you know?
Yeah.
Like first he locked down the description and then he tried to lock down the actual practice.
Right.
As if it were a proprietary method or something.
Yeah.
But as we're finding out, legally, those are two very different things.
Exactly. That initial copyright on the book, that was all about protecting his version, his specific creative choices in how he presented the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
But copyright law, I mean, specifically, we're talking about Section 102B of the Copyright Act, it draws a hard line in the sand. It says straight up that copyright doesn't cover ideas, procedures, processes, like systems, methods of operation, concepts, principles, discoveries. None of that, no matter how you describe it, explain it, illustrate it, even if you embody it somehow. And that's the whole thing, right? That's the idea expression dichotomy, the thing everyone's always talking about.
Okay, so I'm trying to put this into like everyday terms.
Yeah, of course.
Let's say you have this amazing cookbook, beautifully written, original recipes, maybe even with funny stories and gorgeous pictures.
Right.
Copyright would protect that, right?
Yeah.
But it wouldn't stop other chefs from using those same ingredients, following a similar method, to cook the same dish. The copyright's about the unique way the recipe is communicated, not the cooking method itself.
You got it. That's a perfect example. And this isn't some new legal interpretation either. There's this really important precedent. From way back in 1879, a Supreme Court case, Baker v. Selden, it established this fundamental principle. If you have a book that describes a system, any system, in that case, it was bookkeeping, copywriting, that book doesn't mean the author gets a monopoly on using the system.
Interesting.
And the court's reasoning was, if you give someone that much protection, it's going to stifle progress. Others won't be able to use those ideas, those methods, and everyone loses out. Like, imagine if someone could copyright double entry bookkeeping. I mean, commerce would grind to a halt.
Yeah.
And that core principle, the idea that you can't lock up basic ways of doing things, that's what the courts were wrestling with in the Bikram case.
So it all comes down to striking this balance, right? You want to encourage creators to share their work, add to our knowledge, but you don't want to block innovation or prevent people from freely exchanging ideas. That benefits everyone.
You nailed it. That's exactly the tightrope walk that's at the heart of this whole thing. I mean, the Constitution itself, right? It says the whole point of copyright is to promote the progress of science and useful arts, which means there needs to be this balance, too much protection, and it actually backfires. You end up with monopolies over fundamental ways of doing things, and progress gets choked off.
Which loops us right back to Bikram's sequence. How did the courts separate what Bikram could protect, like his specific descriptions, from what they decided was off-limits the sequence itself as this functional system?
That's where the Ninth Circuit's decision is really important. They basically laid out a few key points in their ruling. The first one, and this is the biggie, they said the sequence itself acts like a system or a method, and its main goal is to improve your health and well-being. And it makes sense, right? Bikram himself, in all his marketing, the way he trained teachers, he always emphasized these specific physical and health benefits that came from doing his poses in that exact order.
Got it. So because the point of the sequence was practical, to like enhance your health, not purely artistic or expressive, it leans more towards being a system, and systems aren't copyrightable.
Exactly. The court made this crucial distinction. There's a difference between something that's mainly expressive, like a ballet that's purely artistic, and something that's mainly functional. The sequence was all about achieving something specific, like making you more flexible, stronger, or boosting your heart health. So function over expression in this case.
Makes sense. But what about his argument that it was a compilation of exercises? I mean, copyright law does protect compilations of data or existing materials as long as there's enough originality in how it's selected and arranged.
You're right. That's a key point. And the court addressed it directly. They said, yes, a compilation can be copyrighted if it shows enough originality. But then they said, even if we say Bikram sequence fits the legal definition of a compilation, it still wouldn't be protected. Why? Because it's basically a functional system designed to make people healthier. And when it comes to copyright, the fact that it's a system designed for a specific outcome trumps the whole compilation argument.
So it's like the system part overrides any potential protection as a compilation.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember he also tried to argue that the sequence should be protected as choreography because that is a recognized category for copyright.
Right, right. I remember that.
And the court really dug into that argument too. They said, okay, we get it. In a general sense, the sequence does involve movements. You could call it choreography. But they said, what matters under copyright law is the purpose and the basic nature of the work.
Oh, interesting.
Here's the thing. The main goal of Bikram's sequence was to get you those health benefits, not to express some artistic message or tell a story the way a dance usually does. So just calling it choreography doesn't automatically make it copyrightable.
It's really about what it is, what its purpose is, not just what you label it as.
Exactly. You got it. In fact, to drive this point home, the court used this really clever comparison. They talked about the movements you make when you're shaking a Polaroid picture.
Ah, yeah.
It's a specific series of steps, right?
Right.
But its purpose is totally functional. You shake it so the picture develops properly.
It's not like you're trying to express yourself artistically while you're shaking it.
Exactly. It's not an art form. Yeah. And because of that, you can't go around copywriting the method of shaking a Polaroid.
I love that visual. It's so clear.
Yeah.
So even if someone's really creative in coming up with a functional system, the copyright protection focuses on the way that system is described, not on the system or method itself.
That's it, yeah. And the court also thought about the bigger picture, the public policy implications. They figured if we let Bikram copyright this sequence, he'd basically have a monopoly on a certain way of using yoga to improve health. And that, they said, would stifle competition, hold back new ideas in the field, and that goes against the whole point of copyright, which is to help things move forward for the public good.
Makes sense. You mentioned earlier something called the merger doctrine.
Yeah.
How did that legal principle play into the court's decision?
Ah, good question. So the merger doctrine basically ticks in when there are only a handful of ways, or maybe even just one way, to express an idea or achieve a specific function. In those situations, the idea and the expression become so tightly intertwined that they're considered to have merged, and copyright protection goes out the window. Mm. Now, the Ninth Circuit didn't explicitly say their whole ruling was based on the merger doctrine in the Bikram case, but it's definitely related to their logic.
I see.
They were thinking, if this specific order of 26 poses is really the only way or the absolute best way to get those health benefits Bikram was claiming, then giving him copyright protection for that specific expression would essentially be giving him a monopoly on the entire idea of that specific type of yoga.
Got it. Okay, so everything's starting to click into place now. Mm-hmm. The court really zeroed in on the core purpose and function of the sequence. I'm curious, were there any particularly memorable quotes from the court's opinion that really highlight their overall philosophy in this area?
You know, there were a few. One that stands out, the court said, and I think this is really important, our day-to-day lives consist of many routinized physical movements, from brushing one's teeth to pushing a lawnmower to shaking a Polaroid picture that could be, and in two of the preceding examples, have been characterized as forms of dance.
Right.
Without a proper understanding of the idea-expression dichotomy, one might obtain monopoly rights over these functional physical sequences by describing them in a tangible medium of expression and labeling them choreographic works.
It's like they're saying, hey, watch out, copyright could get out of control if we're not careful. They didn't want to see it creeping into everyday activities.
Precisely. They were very aware of that slippery slope. And then they emphasized another point. Although there is no cause to dispute the many health, fitness, spiritual, and aesthetic benefits of yoga, and Bikram yoga in particular, they do not bring the sequence into the realm of copyright protection.
Okay.
The sequence falls squarely within Section 102B's exclusions from copyright protection, no matter how it is labeled or how ably the label is argued.
So no matter how much you try to dress it up, if it's a system at its core, those benefits don't magically make it copyrightable.
Exactly. And this gets us thinking about all sorts of other areas, right? We talked about CrossFit and Zumba earlier. Based on this ruling, it seems pretty clear that those types of exercise programs wouldn't be copyrightable either, would they?
It seems unlikely, yeah. I mean, if Bikram's sequence, with all its specificity, didn't qualify, I don't see how those would either.
Yeah, I tend to agree. The Ninth Circuit's reasoning strongly suggests that exercise routines, especially those that are created and marketed mainly for their fitness and health benefits, those would probably be considered unprotectable systems or processes.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the focus stays on the function, the outcome, not on any expressive elements.
What about something like recipes?
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Because they're often very specific sequences of steps, and the whole point is to achieve a particular culinary result.
Right.
So where do they fall?
Well, in general, just listing ingredients and laying out step-by-step instructions in a recipe, that's usually considered an idea or a process, not something you can copyright.
Interesting.
The copyright protection for cookbooks, it tends to be around the more creative parts, like the author's voice, personal stories, or pictures, not the actual cooking methods themselves.
I see. So the Bikram case really impacts how we think about protecting methodologies, systems, even with copyright. What about something more modern, like this whole thing with compiling data to train AI?
Yeah.
That's huge these days.
Oh, yeah. That's a really relevant and complex question for sure.
Yeah.
The Bikram case, it highlights how tricky it can be to claim copyright over functional arrangements or compilations, especially when the main goal isn't about creating an expressive work of art.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about AI training data, you could argue that the way you select, organize, and arrange that data is like creating a compilation. But here's the thing. If the whole purpose of that compilation is functional, like you're trying to teach an AI model to do specific tasks or get specific results, and it's not about creating some kind of expressive work, then Bikram might suggest that the compilation itself might not be copyrightable, at least beyond the copyright status of each individual data point in the set. It's a really fascinating area where the legal interpretations are still very much in flux.
It's amazing how a principle like the idea-expression dichotomy, something that's been around for a long time, is still so relevant in these new tech-driven situations.
It really is.
Are there other well-established exceptions in copyright law that are similar to this whole exclusion for functional systems.
Oh, definitely. We see similar exclusions for things like medical procedures and the rules of games. Like, you can copyright a book that describes a new surgical technique or the rules for a board game, but that copyright won't stop other surgeons from doing that technique or people from playing that game according to the rules you wrote down.
Right.
The underlying methods and systems, those are generally considered to be in the public domain, meaning they're free for everyone to use.
Bringing it back to something everyone's familiar with, what about those viral TikTok dance challenges?
Mm.
Could someone actually copyright the specific moves that make up a popular challenge?
Ooh, that's a really good one. It gets right to the heart of what we've been talking about. I think if the dance challenge is just a set of simple, functional movements that are designed for lots of people to do and copy easily, rather than being a complex, original, expressive piece of choreography meant for performance, it probably leans more towards the unprotectable exercise routine side of the Bikram spectrum. The focus there is on how easy it is to copy and on that functional aspect of participation and social connection. But if you have more elaborate original choreography in a TikTok video, especially if it's got those strong expressive elements beyond just basic functional movements, then maybe it could have a stronger argument for copyright, focusing on the expressive parts of the dance itself.
So there might be a line there, depending on how much creative expression is involved versus just basic constructions for a challenge.
Exactly. It's a nuanced situation.
Okay. So this Bikram case, it's a goldmine of learning for law students, especially those who are interested in intellectual property law.
Oh, for sure.
What would you say are the biggest takeaways for them as they study this case?
For law students, Bikram is like the perfect case study in understanding and using the idea expression dichotomy in real life.
Right.
It shows how important it is to really analyze the purpose and function of something when you're trying to figure out if it can be copyrighted.
Uh-huh.
It's a fantastic example for them to practice building arguments for and against applying the exclusions from copyright that we see in Section 102B.
So, like, how should a law student tackle this kind of question if it pops up on an exam or in a legal analysis?
Well, anytime you come across a scenario that involves a process, a system, or a method, the idea expression dichotomy should be your first thought.
Okay.
You need to ask yourself, is this thing mostly expressive, or is it mainly designed to achieve a specific function, to get a specific result? Even if there's creativity involved in coming up with that process, remember that copyright only covers the specific way that process is expressed, not the method itself.
Mm-hmm.
The Bikram Court's analogy with shaking a Polaroid, that's a really good tool to use in legal writing because it explains that difference really clearly.
I agree. That analogy really sticks with you.
It does. And at the end of the day, this case is a great example of those tensions that exist at the heart of intellectual property law, that constant struggle to find the right balance between protecting creators and making sure the public can access useful knowledge and benefit from innovation.
It's a fascinating dilemma for sure.
It is. So to sum up the core of this case, the Ninth Circuit clearly ruled that Bikram sequence, that series of 26 yoga poses plus two breathing exercises, it can't be copyrighted.
Mm-hmm.
Legally speaking, it's considered an idea, process, or system, and those aren't eligible for copyright protection, especially when the system's designed to improve health and well-being, which is what Section 102B lays out.
And the big legal principle underpinning all of this is that idea expression dichotomy.
Look at it.
Copyright law, it'll protect the specific way Bikram described the sequence in his book.
Right.
But it doesn't protect the sequence itself as a method.
Exactly. And the court's reasoning really boils down to this. They decided that the main point of the sequence was to provide health benefits, not to express an artistic or aesthetic message. So even if you call it choreography, if it's basically a functional process at its core, that label won't magically give it copyright protection.
And as we've discussed, this ruling has implications beyond yoga.
Oh, yeah.
It could influence how we think about exercise routines, recipes, maybe even parts of user interfaces or business methods. It shows just how tough it can be to consistently separate what's a protectable expression and what's an unprotectable idea across all these different fields.
It brings up a really important question for you, our listener. As we move into a world where more and more functional systems and methods are being created and shared, should we rethink our copyright laws in any way? Does the traditional idea expression dichotomy still work? Or do we need something else to make sure creators are encouraged, but the public still has access to useful knowledge and new innovations? Something to really think about.
It's a great question. I think the Bikram yoga case will stick with me, for sure. It's a good reminder that while copyright law encourages creative expression, Its ultimate goal is to make sure that those fundamental ideas and practical systems stay in the public domain where they can benefit everyone.
I think that's a great note to end on.
And that's it for our deep dive this week.
See you next time.
Take care.